Okay, here we are. Okay. So everyone settle in well? Everyone okay? Yeah? Anyone not okay? Everyone is almost okay. It's really nice. Very easy. Good. And I know Bianca is very professional. She knows this retreat center inside out, so it's usually very well organized. Good. So I guess we can just start, which is great. Just to give you a little bit of preliminary information, is there anything I should say that I should know about, or is everything is fine? No questions, anything like that. Okay, so we just start away. We don't normally take the eight precepts formally. Everyone knows what the eight precepts are? Is that right? Anyone does not know what the eight precepts are? You've already been told by Bianca, right? Is that how it works? I don't know. Okay. So we just start then, straight just to go away, and let's start with these things. Usually most people know what goes on anyway, and if you have any questions, you can always ask, because we have the Q&A in the evening. So you can always ask, write things down. There are pens and paper outside. So please ask any question you like, and then we can take it from there if it needs to be done, whatever needs to be done. So the idea with this kind of retreat, it is advertised as a sutta and meditation retreat. And the idea is that when you meditate, you have often more ability to understand the suttas, because your mind is hopefully a bit more peaceful, a bit more relaxed. Sometimes you may even become very peaceful. You may experience some joy and happiness and all these kind of things. And the more of these spiritual qualities that you develop, the easier it is to kind of relate to the suttas. And when you relate to the sutta as well, it tends to feed back into your meditation practice. Because you see what is going on, you see the suttas, and maybe you delight a bit in the suttas. And then when you delight in them and you understand what is going on, it tends to make your mind more ready for meditation practice afterwards. So very often the two kind of work really, really well together. That is the idea with this kind of retreat. Is the volume okay, by the way? Can everyone hear all right? Yeah? Okay, good. So that is the first aspect of this. And the other part, which I have always found very important on the Buddhist path, is that meditation is only one aspect of the Buddhist teachings. Meditation practice does not stand alone. It's not something that you can do completely independent of everything else in your life. It fits into everything else that you do. So I think it's often quite useful on a meditation retreat to talk about all of those things. So you get an idea of the overall Buddhist spiritual practice. So that you know what you have to do also in the larger scope of things, what to do when you come back home, how to practice the path overall. Because that is really what matters. When all these factors come together, everything works together, and you practice these things, not just on a meditation retreat, but in your daily life. You make your life into a spiritual path. Your entire life, everything you do becomes part of your spiritual practice. That's when it becomes really powerful. It's not just about going to the retreat center and kind of being spiritual for 9 days and then being worldly for the rest of the time. If you do that, everyone knows that already. It doesn't work if you do it that way. You have to integrate the spiritual life into everything else you do. Is that right, Shivam? Yeah? Nice to see you here anyway. That is how things work out. So for this reason, I like to kind of broaden things out a little bit. Then kind of get a full overview of what this is about. And this year I'm going to talk about something called the 37 Bodhipakkhya Dhammas, which translates to something like the 37 aids to awakening. These are basically all the... I'll talk more about this tomorrow, but these are basically all the various factors on the Buddhist path that are supports for awakening in this life. And if not awakening, supports for any kind of spiritual progress that you make in this life. So we'll have a look at that tomorrow. I'll explain what these things are. But this is kind of the theme for this series retreat. I try to have slightly different theme each year. So as to say at least a little bit some things that are a little bit different. Yeah, usually I like to say exactly the same thing every retreat, but I always try to add a little bit extra as well, so as not to kind of for people fall asleep, especially those who come every year. Like, you know, some of you have been coming for a long time. You can hear a few different things as well. It's nice, a little bit new, but also many of the same good classic suttas, yeah, that really hit home, hit hard, and they kind of drive you in the right direction. So classics and some new things at the same time. That's kind of the idea. But tonight I'm going to start by talking about just meditation practice in general. So no suttas tonight, suttas starting tomorrow morning. And so it's going to give a general overview of meditation practice. And this is the only time I'm going to talk just about meditation is tonight. The rest of the retreat, of course, we're going to touch on meditation all the time, but it's not going to be as directly and explicitly about meditation as it is today. And then I'm going to be giving some guided meditations in the evening. And if you want to come to those, you're very welcome. If you don't like guided meditations, absolutely no reason why you have to come. If you get fed up of hearing my voice after a while, please, that's often a good time to stay in your QT instead or do whatever you like. Everything here is optional. And I learned this from Ajahn Brahm many years ago, that on these retreats, there's only two compulsory things. And those two compulsory things are breakfast and lunch. It's nice, isn't it? That's compassion for you, compassion in action. So you basically do what you like. But at the same time, sometimes it's also useful to have a bit of a structure. And that's why we have a timetable. So if you want to have a bit of structure and you want to have a bit of discipline in your practice, you can use that timetable and you can follow and come in on the hour and come in roughly, come and go roughly at those times, because then there is a minimal disturbance in the room here. People, it's easy to kind of focus and stay peaceful. So that is background. And now let us start talking about meditation practice. And the first thing that I want to mention is that, again, many of the things that I say about meditation are things that I have learned from Ajahn Brahm and learned from the suttas. And one of the things that you see in the suttas is that meditation practice is actually, it takes certain things to be established before you can meditate properly. Meditation is not just a man sitting down and watching the breath just like that, kind of coming in just watching the breath straight away. If you go to the meditation object too quickly, very often you fail in the meditation. And the reason is because the mind is not ready. The mindfulness is not established yet. The mind doesn't have enough clarity. And because the mindfulness is not there, what you end up doing is grasping hold of the meditation object. And I know so many people, they do that. They come in, they sit down, and straight away, they start watching the breath, for example. But it's not the ideal way of practicing meditation. And this is so clear from so many places in the suttas. If you read the Anapanasati Sutta, for example, the Buddha gives a whole sequence of prerequisites before you start watching the breath. And those prerequisites are... there's a number of things there. We're actually going to have a look at that sutta later on, so I won't say too much now. But one of those most important things there is having established mindfulness. Satting parimukkang uppatapetva. Having established mindfulness in front of you. So basically, before you start watching any kind of meditation object, you need to establish mindfulness first. The reason for that is quite, when you think about it, it's quite obvious. Because when you are mindful, mindfulness by its very definition means that you are fairly stable in the present moment. Your mind is not running too much into the past and the future. You have a fairly high degree of clarity about what is going on. So then it is fairly easy to watch the breath because you're already in the present moment. You're already with the breath in a very real sense. You don't have to use any force, don't have to use any willpower. It is a fairly natural process. It's easy, it's comfortable. You feel at ease. if you have to use too much, if you have to force yourself, it becomes often a bit painful after a while because it's not natural. And this is what we want to avoid. You want to make the meditation as pleasant as possible, because when it's pleasant, it is sustainable and it's going to be something very useful for you for a long time, not only here, but for a long time into the future. So setting up the right causes, setting up the right condition before you even start with the meditation practice is actually so important. And only then does it really work. So make sure that you spend plenty of time, today, tomorrow, especially the first few days, to kind of clarify your mind, make your mind ready, so that then when you finally get that mindfulness going, then it actually would be so much more pleasant and so much more enjoyable to do the meditation practice. And hopefully for that reason you also get much more, much better results. So this is one of the kind of critical things that you find in the suttas, and that also people like Ajahn Brahm has always emphasized, at least that's what I remember from all the many years I've stayed with him. Stayed with him for 25 years now, it's a long time. So after a while you become completely dependent. There's no independence anymore. You're fully dependent on your teacher, which is perfectly okay if you have a good teacher. So how does it start out then? How do we get this mindfulness established? And I'm going to start from the very beginning here. And to start out, I would really recommend you, especially for those of you who are fairly new to meditation practice, recommend you to make sure that you are at ease, that you don't have any pains in the body, and that you feel relaxed and at ease in a meditation. That the body is kind of neutral. It is neither too indulgent, and there's nothing. I think it's hard to indulge too much here. We don't have any sofas or armchairs. In some retreat centers I've been to, they have these big sofas. And you see the meditator sitting at the back, leaning on the sofa. Maybe that's a little bit too comfortable, because you're enjoying it too much. But I think everything here is perfectly acceptable, whether you sit on a chair or whatever it is. So first of all, be at ease. Make sure you don't have too much pain in the body. And this goes from the very beginning, especially, because in the beginning, when mindfulness isn't established yet, it's even more difficult to deal with pain in the body. So make sure you are relaxed. You don't have to sit on the floor if you're not comfortable. Sometimes people think that to meditate you have to sit on the floor, and if you don't sit on the floor you are a second class meditator. But don't think like that. Everyone is a first class meditator. What happens is whether you are making progress or not. That's the only thing that matters. Whether you are enjoying yourself or not, that's what really matters. So change your posture around a little bit. It's very hard to sit on the floor all the time, unless you're kind of born in that posture. So change around. Sit on a chair sometime, sit on the floor, sit in different ways, different postures. Use the little benches that we have. Use as many cushions as you like. I've seen people using enormous amounts of cushions sometimes, especially as the retreat goes on, the number of cushions start to increase. So it's the length of the, now how does it work? The number of days into the treat is directly proportional to the number of cushions used, or something like that. We should make mathematical equations out of this. So be comfortable, be at ease. It is almost impossible to be too comfortable in a place like this. So make sure you have the body is just right. And it's amazing how important such a basic instruction actually is. It may seem very obvious to you because you have been around Ajahn Brahm for so long perhaps, but actually it is not really obvious at all. And in my experience, the vast majority of Buddhists, they experience far too much pain in the meditation practice, and because of that they very often give up on meditation, and they give up on the benefits that can be had by, making the mind peaceful, and all the happiness and joy that can come from that. There are so many types of meditation around the world where the idea of pain is not discouraged at all, even encouraged. Sit completely still, don't move for long periods of time. And actually, in my opinion, it is not the right way of doing meditation practice. And in fact, it's not really my opinion, it's the opinion of the Buddha. because this comes back to the idea of the middle way. Yeah, basic teaching of the Buddha. The very first thing the Buddha said after his awakening, the first time he opened his mouth, talked about the Dhamma, he said, middle way. And what is that middle way? Well, it is precisely the middle way between not indulging the body and the five senses on the one hand and not finding pain in the body on the other hand. In other words, not purposely creating pain. And by sitting for long hours in one posture without moving, sometimes you are purposefully creating pain that is not really necessary. So the middle way, And I would say, I always suggest to people that if you're going to err, if you're going to make a mistake, make a mistake on the side of a little bit too much indulgence. Yeah, if you have any doubt, have that extra cup of tea here. If you have any doubt, sleep that extra half an hour in the morning so you feel really refreshed. So your mindfulness kind of, the point of sleep is to kind of maximize your mindfulness. Yeah, so find that middle way here. But if in doubt, sleep a little bit extra because it's better that way than actually being dull because of not enough sleep or whatever it is. Because if you err on the side of a little bit too much indulgence, at the very least, you're not going to suffer too much. And if you don't suffer too much, it is more likely that you will keep on practicing for a long time into the future and therefore gain many of the benefits of this path. So that is far preferable. So the middle way, and it's fascinating, there is a reason why the Buddha made this his first teaching. And the reason, of course, is that human beings, we tend to kind of go to extremes. Either we kind of become really kind of spiritual practitioners, and then we go way over to the other side, or we indulge in our sensual life and go to the other side. But finding the middle way is actually quite rare. And what is interesting is that even the Buddha, if you go to the one of the suttas that I often quote, is the Bodhirajakumara Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya, Middle Length Sayings, number 85, where the Buddha is in conversation with Prince Bodhi, Bodhirajakumara, Prince Bodhi. Prince Bodhi says to the Buddha, he says that it is through pain that happiness is to be gained. Yeah, this is one of those, this was kind of the way that the spiritual path was understood in those days in ancient India. And if you go to India today, you see all of these sadhus going around standing on one leg. Still, lots of people think in exactly the same way. Yeah? So this is kind of very much part of the human psyche, the idea that through pain, that is how you gain happiness. And it's not just in ancient India or in modern India, it's also in Christianity you find the same thing. Apparently you find the same thing in Islam. And lo and behold, you find the same thing in Buddhism as well. Even though the Buddha said we should not do this, still we keep on doing exactly the same thing. So it seems to be buried very deeply somehow in the human psyche that through pain, that is how we gain something. No pain, no gain, as the saying goes. But then the Buddha says to Bodhirajakumara, to Prince Bodhi, he says, well, that's what I thought too before my awakening. Yeah. In other words, I too had this wrong view, the wrong idea that it is through pain that you actually achieve happiness, that by torturing the body and all these kind of things that would lead to awakening or lead to some kind of benefit. I had exactly the same wrong view. Yeah. From having said that, then he says to Prince Bodhi, he says, well, actually, but this is what I discovered. And then he teaches Prince Bodhi the gradual training, the gradual path, starting from the very beginning all the way to awakening. And as part of teaching that gradual path, he points out that each stage on that gradual path has its own kind of happiness. If you are practicing virtue, you already have some happiness because of virtue. It's called the Anavajja Sukha, the happiness of being blameless. Then you have the Abhyaseka Sukha, which is the happiness of some kind of purity. And then it goes on and on like that. And there's a degree of happiness all the way through. So Buddhism, or the spiritual path, is not pain leads to happiness. What it is if you practice in the right way, then actually every stage of the path leads to a certain spiritual kind of happiness. And that spiritual happiness leads you on to the next spiritual happiness, all the way to Nibbana being the highest spiritual happiness. So it's a gradual path in happiness. That is really what the spiritual path is about. If you do it in the right way, that is how it should come out. very beautiful. Yeah, one happiness after the other one. One happiness leading to a higher happiness. You need the lower happiness to get the higher one. That's essentially what the Buddha is saying. Instead of pain, you focus on the positive things instead, on the spiritual path. Very deeply rooted in human beings, so deeply rooted that the Buddha himself had that wrong view before he started out. This is one of the things that you find in the suttas. When the Buddha talks about his own practice, basically he had the same problems that we all have. Yeah, he's talking about having defilement sometimes, he's talking about having wrong view. He's talking about struggling on the path to get into jhanas, as in the Upakilesa Sutta, and all of these things. So if you are struggling on the path, you are in very good company. Yeah, we're trying to kind of find our way through this. And for that reason, we need to take on board the Buddha's message as best as we can. So find that middle way. When you find that middle way, what you discover is that the body starts to disappear. Because if there is no pain to be had through the body, if there is no indulgence or sensual pleasures to be had through the body becomes irrelevant. Yeah, it's kind of, who cares about the body? It doesn't have any pain, doesn't have any pleasure. And that is precisely where we want to go. Because when the body is irrelevant, that is where we can focus on the meditation object, and we can focus on the mental aspect of things rather than the physical aspect of things. So it's in one sense, it's not really a middle way at all, as someone pointed out to me a while ago. It was actually one of the nuns, I think. Yeah, and it's not, okay. And it's not really a middle way at all. It's actually getting away from the body and moving on instead to the mental world. That's really what it is about. So in one sense, you could argue it's not really a middle way. But in another sense, it is. Do that to the best of your ability. Remember that throughout the retreat. And if you start to feel a little bit too much dukkha, too much things get too terrible, then take a step back and ask yourself if you can make it a bit more easy, happy, and more kind of more joyful or whatever it is, so that you don't kind of suffer too much. Otherwise, it's going to be problematic. Very simple little thing, but I think very important to remember, because so many people forget about this. So many. Almost everyone forgets about this. So please don't be one of those who forget about this. Sometimes you do, yeah, and that's okay. Then you learn and you kind of get yourself back on track again. Yeah, and then you kind of carry on and eventually you get past that. So that is the very beginning. And once you find a good posture for yourself, and when it gets too painful, you move around a little bit, that's okay. Please feel free to move. You don't have to sit in one posture all the time. The next thing is to learn to really fully relax. You can be fully at ease and fully really enjoy sitting here. Yeah, so you start off when the body feels right, and still there is often some tension left in the body. And that tension often comes from the mind, because the mind is very active, and the mind does things, and very often the whatever emotions we have, we can often feel them in the body. Yeah, the body tenses up because of certain emotions or whatever. So the idea, next thing to do, is really to relax the body to the maximum. And as you relax the body, you find the mind also relaxes, because again, these two things are very closely connected with each other. And to do this, actually I should say, one of the nice things also about not having pain in the body and looking after yourself so that you don't actually have too much of these negative feelings in the body, one of the nice things about that, it encourages a little bit of kindness and care towards yourself. Yeah, which is a very important attitude to have. If you get too much into the idea of you're going to be tough and you're going to kind of deal with the pain or whatever, sometimes this can be a very hard kind of mind state, yeah, where you don't really kind of have that sense of care and gentleness that is required for the mind to be right. So simply by looking after yourself and saying, okay, I'm not going to do all this pain stuff or whatever, it's a degree of kindness there. And that kindness is a attitude that you want to bring with you on the path. So already there, you're building up that right attitude. And that right attitude you then bring in to the next stage, which is the stage of just allowing to let things go, not to be so tense, not to be have all those tensions or whatever in the body, if you take that kindness with you from the very beginning, it's easier then to kind of de-stress and relax also later on in the practice. And a lot of this is that attitude, but a lot of it is also just the idea of giving yourself time. Yeah, because very often it takes time to leave the world behind and to let everything be and then to allow the body to de-stress. So patience is one of the very important things on this path. So be really patient. Give yourself today, tomorrow, and however long it takes to really, really relax until you feel so at ease, you feel so nice. And then when you come and sit down, your body is, and your mind are largely prepared for the meditation practice. And that patience, that ability to just sit back and allow things to be, is one of the critical things. And one of the ways the Buddha talks about this, when the Buddha talks about meditation practice, one of the very surprising things that he says about meditation practice, he says that it cannot be done through willpower. Such a beautiful saying, because I remember Ajahn Brahm telling me this year after year. I said, yeah, I always thought, whatever. I wasn't all that convinced. Yeah. And then one day you kind of look through the suttas and think, wow, lo and behold, there it is, right there in the suttas. And this is some of those powerful moments when you realize that the way you have been taught all along is exactly in line with the word of the Buddha. It's so reassuring, yeah, when you see that. It actually feels, you know that you're on the right track. So the Buddha says this whole path, when we start off by just kind of coming from the ordinary life and hopefully we live a good life, yeah, now you're going to find out how good your ordinary life is, because the better your ordinary life is, the better your meditation is going to be. We are kind of hostage to our ordinary actions when it comes to meditation practice. Those ordinary life is going to limit us or enhance our practice depending on how well good we are at living our general life. So once you start out, whatever you come here to this retreat with, now all you have to do is to allow things to be here and allow the process to happen by itself. Once the virtue is in place, the sila is in place, the habits, the good habits are in place, the rest of the path does not happen through an act of will. In fact, the Buddha specifically says it cannot happen through an act of will. He says it is a natural process. It's dhammata. Dhammata means according to nature. So if it is according to nature and you try to force it, if you try to pull that little flower because you want it to grow faster, you're going to destroy the flower. In the same way, if you try to make the meditation go faster, if it is a natural process, all you're going to do is get in the way. So stand back. Don't do anything. Be passive in your meditation practice. Learn just to allow things to be here, especially actually all the way through the practice. This is so important. And if you can learn that from the very beginning, you're learning something very useful about how to deal with your mind. So stand back. And the more you stand back, the more you will realize that the tensions that are in the body, that come from your mind, and if you allow everything to be, the mind starts to calm down. Why? Because the mind is actually run by our intentions and all the kind of volition, all the will behind it. So by allowing things to be, which is the opposite of using willpower and volition, things naturally calm down. It has to happen because you're no longer feeding all the thinking, you're no longer feeding the defilements of the mind. So then things kind of calm down automatically. So it's great just being able to stand back, doing nothing. And to be able to do this, it is useful sometimes to have some ideas about how meditation actually works. And very often when we think about meditation practice, we think it's something we have to do. I'm going to meditate. Okay, I'm going to meditate. And we think it's some kind of action, some kind of activity, meditation. You have some kind of idea. Because it sounds like an activity. You sit down, you watch your breath. And we are such habitual doers. We are such habitual doers that straight away when we hear that meditation is kind of a thing, we think we have to do the meditation. But really, that is where we tend to go wrong already. And it can be very hard to get out of that habit of doing the meditation. I know people who have been meditators for years, And they have been very good meditators, coming very, very deeply with lots of happiness and piti, sukha, lots of tranquility and all of these kind of things. And they've been telling me that after 15 years of meditation, and they have been doing really, really well, still they've been doing too much. This habit of doing is very profound, and you can take it with you all the way to the doorstep of the jhanas. Only then do you really let go of it fully. So it's useful to learn from the very beginning to stand back and allow things to be. So instead of doing the meditation, one of the ways of thinking about it is to think about what happens when you come down after a long day's work and you are really tired. Yeah, what do you do? Well, what you do, you may have your favorite armchair at home, yeah, or whatever it is, and then you just sit back and you kind of take a breath, yeah? And do you do anything at that point? You do absolutely nothing, yeah? You just sit there, you allow things to run through your mind, you allow your body to relax, everything to be, because you are exhausted, yeah? You allow things to be, you allow your mind to run, you allow your body just to kind of hang there, whatever it wants to do. And meditation is a little bit like that. It is not the kind of the slothful posture and the kind of that aspect of it, but it's similar in the sense that you just allow things to be. And when you sit in that armchair and you feel exhausted, just by sitting there, yeah, and you allow things to calm down a little bit, after a while you feel better. And the reason you feel better is because you have let go a little bit. You have allowed things to be. And then your energy comes back. And then you're able to operate again afterwards. And this is very parallel to what we do in our meditation practice. You allow everything to be. And as you do so, because you're not using the muscles of the mind, you're not using up all that energy through using your will, the energy comes back into your mind again. And this is how the mind gradually becomes more energetic through the meditation practice. So sometimes just little ideas like that, little ideas of how to think and how to relate to meditation practice can be very useful to allow yourself to kind of get in the right mood. So again, the Buddha says, don't do anything. Allow all of this to happen. Be that person in the armchair, but sit a little bit straighter, otherwise you fall asleep straight away. Yeah, but kind of roughly like that. Yeah, enjoying yourself, sitting down. Whoa, so nice. And then you are on the right track. And it will take time, but eventually what happens is that the mindfulness starts to come. The world starts to be left behind. You don't think about the world so much anymore. This is one of the great things about coming here to Jhana Grove. You're far away from your home situation. Your family is not here. Your work is not here. All of these things that we are kind of caught up in the world, all of that is left behind. And now you can actually leave it behind gradually, mentally as well. This is one of the great things about going away a little bit. The Buddha always says that you need to move away, yeah, from your habits to be able to meditate, one of the kind of crucial things. And this is kind of partly what we're doing here. So mindfulness starts to come, yeah, and mindfulness starts to arise. So how can we encourage this mindfulness when it starts to arise? And there's many tricks of perception that you can do. First of all, you have to have a little bit of mindfulness. Once you have a little bit of mindfulness, you can think with a bit more clarity. Then you can start to use your perceptions to enhance the mindfulness even further. Oops. Has it moved around or is it... which way is it supposed to go? Okay, this way. Yeah. Okay, thanks. Thank you. Ooh. Okay. Okay. So what are some of these perceptions that we can use to kind of help us with the practice? One of the things that I would sometimes maybe recommend you to do is to remind yourself what is really important in life. When you sit down and you find yourself thinking about all kinds of things, and it's almost guaranteed that you're going to do that sometimes during this retreat. You're going to think about your home, about your work, about your family, about whatever it is. It's almost impossible to go on a 9-day retreat without thinking about these things occasionally. Yeah, it's going to happen. For some of you, it's going to happen more, for some of you, less, depending on how kind of long you've been doing this. But it's a very common thing. So when that happens, One of the things to do is to remind yourself of your priorities. What is really important in life? What really matters? Yeah, and if what is really matters in your life is your work and your family and all of these other things, if that is kind of the top of your priority list, and especially in the modern day we have the mindfulness movement and all of that, and with the mindfulness movement the idea is to enhance or use mindfulness to improve the other aspects of our life. So if you use meditation and mindfulness to improve all the other aspects of your life, what that means is that you are placing all these other aspects higher up, and mindfulness just becomes a support for the other things. Yeah? And of course, if you do it that way, then because the other things are more important, and mindfulness and meditation and the spiritual life is secondary, you're going to think about those things during meditation practice. Why? Because they're more important. The mind always goes to those things that it thinks are important. That's what the mind prioritizes by default. It's very obvious when you think about it, yeah, because what is important to us, that is what we think about, that's where we hang out, that's our bhava. If you look at dependent origination, you have the 10th link of dependent origination, it's called bhava. That's kind of our existence, if you like, that's where we hang out. So what you want to do instead, you want to turn this upside down. And instead of making meditation secondary, instead of making meditation a support for your ordinary life, you make your ordinary life a support for your meditation practice. So when you do it like that, it changes things completely. You think about your ordinary life, your family life, your work, and all the other things that you do. And you use that in such a way that it supports what you're doing now. Yeah, so when you go back home, of course you are kind to your family members. In fact, you are more kind than ever before. In your work, you do a good job because you know doing a good job is always a positive thing. You feel good about yourself afterwards. Whatever you do in life, you do it in a good way, but you do it for a higher purpose. And that higher purpose is a spiritual path. In this way, by living in this way, by making the spiritual path the most important thing and making everything else secondary, you actually enhance both at the same time. That is kind of the magic about this. It doesn't mean you become callous or careless in your ordinary life, but actually it means you put extra effort into making your ordinary life even more pure, even more filled with kindness, even more filled with care. Why? Because it will support your spiritual life. And once you turn your life upside down like that, compared to how most other people live, it means that you are here now. Now is what you're doing, what really matters. When you come to this retreat center, you have the chance to touch things that are profoundly meaningful in this life, far more meaningful than anything you can ever experience in ordinary life. And because this is what is profoundly meaningful, because you understand this is what really matters, everything else is secondary, it means that you don't think about your ordinary life during meditation anymore. So try this perception sometimes. Remind yourself what really matters. And if you're really able to see that these other things are secondary, they're not really important, actually it is not that hard to let go of them. Why? Because why are you going to think about and talk about things that are secondary importance when you are doing what really matters? It's a little bit like if you are in a really nice restaurant. Yeah, you are in a really nice restaurant. You're enjoying kind of five-star restaurant or whatever, with, you know, whatever food it is. You're not going to think about McDonald's while you're eating there. Or are you? Probably not, yeah. So, and this is exactly the same thing when you are doing a spiritual life. If you really are understand that this is superior, you're not going to think about those other things when you practice here. I hope you don't feel offended by that simile, but just trying to kind of make a point there. Yeah, you're doing what really is important, what really matters. So these little perceptions like that can sometimes be very supportive because it helps you to remind you what matters. And we always need reminding because it's so easy to slip back to the old habits. And you may see it sometimes this perception will work, other times it won't work. So try to remind yourself, try to clarify these kind of perceptions during this retreat. And they will come in very handy also later on. When you go back home or whatever else you do, these kind of perceptions can be incredibly useful. So use this perception, and then your mindfulness hopefully becomes even stronger as a consequence. You continue to relax, you allow the whole process to go, mindfulness comes up even more strongly. And at a certain point in this process, you can start watching your meditation object. You have to find out what that point is by little bit by trial and error. Yeah, I'm not going to tell you exactly when that is, because you really have to figure it out when you have enough clarity, when you have enough peace to do it. All I can do is tell you about all these supporting things that allows you to get there. That's really what I think is my job. It's looking at how the Buddha talks about these things, I think that is the right way to think about it. So mindfulness comes. And as mindfulness comes, you have that beautiful Bhaddhekaratta Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya 131, the mid-length sayings of the Buddha, number 131, where the Buddha says that do not go into the future, do not think, do not, something like that, do not go forward into the future, do not go back into the past, for the future has not yet come and the past is already finished. Instead, see with clarity into the presently arisen phenomena right here and now. Yeah, don't go back into the future. Don't go to the past. Stay with the presently arisen phenomena. What are those phenomena? Well, they're like the breath, for example. Yeah, that's one of those phenomena that we can see right here in the present moment. That's where you want to hang out. So have a look at that sutta. It's a very nice one, actually. It's not part of the suttas for this retreat. But it's one of those very simple things that reminds you of, you know, letting go of these things. And I remember Ajahn Brahm in his book on the basic method of meditation, he talks about the future and the past as two heavy suitcases. Remember that? You can always carrying these heavy suitcases around, and then one day you let go of them, and you feel so light in comparison to what you felt before. So letting go of the future and the past is often very important, because you find that even when your mindfulness gets stronger, or perhaps sometimes, especially when your mindfulness becomes stronger, sometimes you get memories coming from the past that you haven't had for a long time. So you need to deal with these things to make your mind even more peaceful. So how do we deal with the past and the future in a skillful way? For the past, very often the reason why we kind of hang on to the past, very often there's some kind of unfinished business there. Yeah, there's some kind of problem we had in the past with somebody. Maybe we feel a bit guilty about something, or we have done something bad, or somebody did something bad towards us, and we feel terrible about that. And so a large part of dealing with the past is about having forgiveness for the past. And this is a very important part of the Buddhist practice, the ability to forgive, the ability to let go. Very often we say you should let go of the past. Well, how do you do that? Well, actually you do it through forgiveness. And that forgiveness happens when you understand what other people really are like. This is one of the things I will talk about quite a bit more later on, how to forgive the past in such a way that you can just kind of let it go pretty much straight away. And this may sound like some kind of magic trick, because letting go is often so difficult. But if you use the right attitude, if you think about people in the right way, the strange thing is that forgiving actually is not that difficult to do. It's just a matter of looking at people in the right way, understanding people. And one of the things that I will talk about later on is the idea that people are basically, to a large extent, they are automatons. They run according to a certain program. They have been conditioned in a certain way. They can't really be different from what they are. It's a very simple idea, but it follows from the Buddhist idea of non-self. And once you get that, once that really sinks in, forgiveness actually is almost second nature. You can forgive like that. Why? Because you know that it's just a process. It's like getting angry with a robot. It's like getting angry with a red light, when you come down the street. It's as silly as that. And because of that, you can let go. You can forgive. And when you can forgive and let go, that is when the past kind of gets sorted out. That is about dealing with the past, and sometimes you will find that this can be very useful in your meditation. You're meditating away, and then something happens which is slightly unpleasant or whatever, and then suddenly you can deal with it using some very simple perceptions, as the one I just suggested now. I'll talk much more about this later on, because it is a very useful thing to bring with you into your meditation practice. The second thing then is how to deal with the future. Yeah, the future hasn't arrived yet. How do we deal with that? And one of the ways of dealing with the future is always to remember that the future that we often look forward to, that we think we're going to control, that we think we're going to make something out of, actually tends to be far less interesting than we think. Yeah. And one of the great teachings of the Buddha, which I can't remember whether it's on the list of suttas now, but it is the idea that everything that is dear and pleasing to us must become otherwise, must become separated from us. And this is a very profound teaching, actually. It may seem very obvious on the one hand. Yes, we know that everything dear and pleasing has to, people have to die, we have to die one day. But it's actually very profound because it means that everything in the world of the five senses ultimately is unsatisfactory. Ultimately will let you down, ultimately will be problematic. Why? Because ultimately we're going to have to let it go. Ultimately we are going to have to die. Very often it will go long before we die. So every time you enjoy something in that world, every time you attach to something in that world, you're basically asking for suffering down the track. So once you understand the inherent problem of the world of the five senses, you understand why meditation is the real refuge. The Buddha specifically says that you should be an island unto yourself, yeah? Which means, he also says that, that it means that meditation practice, the satipatthanas, is where you find a refuge from that world. Why? Because you are withdrawing from the five senses and you're withdrawing inside of yourself instead. So remember that. Yeah, the world outside is inherently unsatisfactory. It's always going to let you down at the end. At the very latest when you die, but it's always going to let you down. This is where you find a real refuge. The future is completely irrelevant. And to make that kind of clear to myself, sometimes I just tell myself very simply that I have no future. Because that future out there is so uninteresting, because it's not something that is a real goal or a real purpose or anything real to go towards. I just remind myself, I have no future. Because that future actually doesn't matter. It's completely irrelevant. It's only the present moment. Come back to what you have now. Everything else is kind of out of control and unsatisfactory. So again, it's a simple idea to bring you back to what you have now and to kind of let go of all of those things in the world that we tend to think are important. All of those things in the world that we tend to think about ultimately are no real goals, no real purposes, and problematic if you keep on going with these things in the long run. So again, a small perception just to help you to kind of think about things in the right way. And if you think about these things in the right way, then letting go of the past and the future should be possible. Especially if you build up these perceptions over time and you understand what I'm talking about and how the Buddha talks about these things, then letting go of these things actually becomes not that difficult. Of course, it depends on many other factors as well. It depends on enjoying your meditation, because if you enjoy the meditation, the mind will not tend towards these things. So it has to do with things like making the present moment the pleasant moment, that kind of stuff. Because when the present moment is pleasant, it's easy to stay in the present. Yeah, if the present moment is not pleasant, the mind will automatically tend to move into these things. And then you can think as much about the disadvantage of the past and future as you like, and it may still not work because the mind will always incline away from the suffering of the present moment. So making the present moment is also very important. And this leads me to the last important thing on the topic of meditation. Yeah. So first of all, you start out with allowing the body to be first of all, not painful. Then you keep on relaxing and you allow things to be, allow the mind to become clear, and mindfulness starts to arise. Then you use these various perceptions to let go of the past and the future. Mindfulness becomes even more powerful. And around this time somewhere is where watching the breath starts to become attractive and become natural. But there's one more ingredient that is required to make the meditation really work properly. That very last ingredient is the ingredient ingredient of joy and happiness in the meditation practice. Because there is that joy and happiness ultimately that becomes the glue that draws you into deeper meditation. When the joy and happiness arises, that is where it really starts to become fun to be a meditator. So how can we do this? How can we give rise to this joy and happiness in meditation? And this usually happens after mindfulness has already arisen, after you are watching your meditation object. And sometimes what you need to do is to nudge the mind a little bit. And by nudge, I mean not think a lot, but just give rise to a perception that helps you to see things in a more positive way, that gives rise to maybe even joy and happiness inside. What are those things? And there is many things to do, many ways of doing this. And this is one of the areas that the Buddha actually emphasizes a lot in the suttas, how to give rise to that joy. And he specifically talks about six different ways of doing that. And these ways are Buddha Dhamma Sangha Nusati, Buddha Nusati, Dhamma Nusati, Sangha Nusati, the recollection of the Buddha, the Dhamma, and the Sangha, Chaga Nusati, recollection of your generosity. Sila Nusati, recollection of your conduct. These things are very simple things. Often they are just about sitting back and allowing your mind to go back into something in the past that was beautiful, a beautiful action that you did, the idea that you have lived well for a long time, and just feel what that feels like. Maybe bring yourself, connect with something you did in the past that gave you great joy, and try to connect with that once again, so you can bring that joy into the present moment. You remember sometime in the past that was very positive for you. You allow that to arise in the present moment. Chaganusati, Devatanusati, recollection of the devas. I won't talk about that now, but maybe later on. Another way of doing this, and this I'm going to talk about this later on as well, and that is the thinking about your kalyanamitas. And this is a way of bringing joy which I think is within reach for the vast majority of people. And that is the idea, how fortunate we are, every one of us, to have so many good spiritual friends. If you think about it, the number one spiritual friend is the Buddha. The Buddha is going to be there in the background throughout this retreat. The Buddha is going to be there all the way in the background. But the Buddha can be a little bit difficult to relate to sometimes because he seems far away in culture and far away in time. So sometimes doing the Buddha Nusati doesn't necessarily give rise to joyful people. So here's the first kalyanamita. Then you have the monastic community. You have all these people who professionally live the spiritual life, and what a wonderful thing it is to have that in the world as well. And especially here in Perth, we have a very strong monastic community, which is great. So you have the monastic community there. These are also kalyanamitas. And then lastly, you have all the people, all the lay people who also practice this path, all the people who come on retreats like this, all your friends in your ordinary life, the people who come to Dhammaloka Center, people you meet online or whatever it is, everyone who supports each other in actually practicing this path properly. And everyone really wishing everyone else well, everyone trying to support everyone else, trying to live in the right way. And what a wonderful thing it is to live at a time when you have all of these assemblies, all of these people around, both bhikkhus and bhikkhunis, both laymen and laywomen, everyone practicing together in this way, and everyone supporting each other, mutual support and mutual respect. What a wonderful thing that is. And when you think like that, how fortunate you are to have all these gems and jewels in your life, to be there to support you. Just that idea can often be enough to give rise to a sense of joy and happiness. How blessed you are to live in an age when these things are present. It is not obvious that these things should be there, but they are still present in the present day and age. And what a wonderful thing that is. And then you start to feel a sense of gratitude to the people around you. You feel a sense of gratitude for all the people who are here on this retreat, here to support you, here to practice in the same way. You have a sense of metta for them because you see that all the people here are good people. If you weren't a good person, you wouldn't bother coming here. There's no point in coming here torturing yourself for 9 days if you're a bad person. If you are a mafia person or you're something like that, and you... you have other things. There's no point in coming here. So you know by default that the people coming here are good people. So remind yourself of that. And you remind yourself of that, you feel the joy, and then you have metta for everyone around you. And when you have metta for everyone around you, it also means that the retreat is so much more smooth, so much more easy, because it is so easy to allow the mind to be distracted by tiny little things that may happen during the day or whatever. But instead, you remember how fortunate you are, and you have that gratitude, you have that metta, and then everything becomes far more powerful as a consequence. So these are some of the ways of giving rise to joy. There are other ways as well, such as practicing just metta meditation. And there is whatever way works for you. And sometimes all you have to do is watch the breath, and the joy arises as a consequence. But that joy is really one of the great benefits of meditation practice. And when you start to taste that joy, it's a joy that is very different from any joy that you can experience in ordinary life. It has a spiritual flavor to it. It has a purity to it that is very different from everything else. You really know, you really understand what the spiritual path is about. And that is only the beginning. Yeah, and then it goes on and on and on like that. But the purpose of this talk is only to get you started. Because if you get that far, if you're able to trigger some of these things, the peace, the joy, the mindfulness on the path, then the rest will happen largely automatically. And it will just go on and on and on, and then you will kind of move onwards in your meditation practice. So that is the idea of meditation. How I understand that the Buddha taught meditation practice, especially things like the preliminary, or maybe a preliminary is the wrong word, especially things like Anapanasati. From that basic preliminary practice, all the calm, all the samatha, all the vipassana, all the insight, everything arises out of that. And then you get all the benefits of practicing this path. I've been talking for an hour pretty much already, so I'm probably going to stop very soon. So that is just a little bit of background information. If what I was saying wasn't clear, and it may have been a bit rambling, so I apologize if that was the case, but please feel free to ask questions about meditation practice later on, and we can take those in the evening as we move along through this 9-day retreat. Now, maybe we should do a little bit of meditation together. I can't remember the schedule anymore, but anyway, it doesn't matter. Let's do some meditation together, and then after that, have a good night, and we'll meet you again tomorrow morning at 6 a.m. or something like that.